case today, which is United States versus Rogers. Ms. Smith?
Yes. May it please the court. Mr. Lloyd. Again, my name is Andrea Smith. I'm here on behalf of appellant Kelvin Rogers. And I'm gratified to say that I don't come here often and have the government concede on one of the issues, or the main issue that we raise. And of course, that's the issue about whether the district court below had the authority to enlarge and expand Mr. Rogers' supervised release term without some notice or hearing, and taking it from a 30-month term to a 50-month term after the second revocation. And the government has conceded that under the both the statute and the applicable federal rule of criminal procedure that the court did not have that authority.
Now, isn't the standard of review plain error here?
Yes.
Because
I might agree that automatically, Judge. I had alleged, of course, de novo. I apologize.
No one suggested below that Judge Murphy was required to extend the term of supervised release before revoking it, did they?
No, Your Honor, and if the question goes to whether the previous counsel, I was not defense counsel at the hearing below, whether defense counsel should have made a more formal objection on the record to Judge Murphy having done that, that may well have been the case. But if I may, in the real give and take of the courtroom, there's a couple of things going on. One, there was no notice at all that Judge Murphy was thinking about that. And of course, this is a case of first impression, so it's never been done before. So I don't think the defense counsel below was thinking of that. And the other real issue is that the counsel below did not bring that up with Judge Murphy because as a tactic, and I probably would not have either, because Judge Murphy could have said, oh, well, if you don't think I have the jurisdiction or authority to extend it, then I'm just going to give him more time in prison. And he could have given him the 56 months in prison instead of the 6 months that he ordered him, because that was...
That takes you too far, though, really, because, I mean, we have both a substantive question here, whether you can go beyond 30 months at all, you know, in any way, and we also have a procedural question whether Judge Murphy had to do it by, A, extending first, you know, back out to 50, and then revoking and imposing the new term, or B, by doing it the way he did it. And even if we think on this record Mr. Rogers said enough as a pro se person to alert the district court to the fact that he had a question about the expansion, I see nothing about the procedural thing. It seems to me what his lawyer would have been afraid of is that Judge Murphy would have said, fine, we'll stay here for another 5 minutes or I'll continue this hearing until tomorrow and we'll talk about whether it should be extended out and we're going to extend it. So, I mean, if our review on the procedural issue is for plain error, it seems to me it's awfully hard to say that he committed plain error in extending it using the procedures he did instead of these other procedures.
And I apologize, Judge. I'm not sure. Of course, Mr. Rogers asserts as de novo, but even if it's not, Mr. Rogers asserts even under a plain error review that it still needs to be reversed and remanded. So I'm not sure.
That could be very dangerous.
So where are we going then? We reverse and remand.
Goes back down with some instructions from this court to tell the Judge Murphy that he did not have the authority to.
So now I can do it, correctly and give him more time.
Right. I mean, any way you look at it, wouldn't it be a Pyrrhic victory? I mean, if not even a Pyrrhic victory, like a Pyrrhic...
Of course, one of the issues here, again, is that it will make some law on this issue and put defense counsel and the criminal federal bar in general on notice about this issue. This is an issue of first impression. No one was thinking that way. I don't think even Judge Murphy was necessarily thinking about the applicable statute or the applicable federal rule of criminal procedure. So I think.
But wouldn't the same result come about if we just said, look, Judge Murphy, you may not have followed the correct procedure here, but it's clear that the outcome would have been the same even if you had done it correctly, if not worse.
One of the things about that, of course, is that, as you suggested, Judge Wood, if he had a hearing where he has counsel, first of all, he had to be provided notice. So defense counsel could have prepared for the issue about an enlargement, an extension, an enlargement of the supervised release term. So if the defense counsel had notice of that, he could or I could prepare if it's reversed or remanded back down.
But
to prepare some arguments.
Say, I mean, I understand that if it had been back then, but at this point, if I understand you correctly, you agree that with the right hearing, the judge had the fundamental power to extend the supervised release term back out to something inside that original 60 months minus the various imprisonment terms. We'll just call that 50 months, okay? Because if that's true, then it seems to me pretty much the rest of it washes away, since you're not taking the hard line position that under no circumstances after Johnson could the new supervised release term exceed that new 30-month cap less the 6 months in prison. As long as you're not doing that, I don't really see what's left.
I see what you're getting at, Judge Wood, and if I may, when I was briefing this issue and trying to come up with an argument pursuant to this court
order, yes.
The February 14th order, and the case was handed off unto me, I was trying to do a pass between the Marlowe decision by the Sixth Circuit, which said, of course, under the general statute authority, 3583A, that the Sixth Circuit said there was authority to enlarge and give more than the original term. Now, of course, this court's decision of August 15th under the Russell case
right. Says
that Marlowe was wrong. I was trying to, when I made my original argument, I was trying to wind my way between those two holdings. So I came up with the challenge as it stands now on the record. Given this court's decision in the Russell case 3 weeks ago, I might very well go back to what you're suggesting, Judge Wood, and say that Johnson does prohibit that. There is this statute, of course, that allows for enlargement. Johnson, of course, does not directly address the issue about whether a court can use that statute and expand on a previous term of supervised release to enlarge it back to what was originally opposed before a previous revocation. Of course, Johnson doesn't address that issue.
But what the thing that concerns me is if we held the district court judges, forgetting for the moment about the procedures, because if we establish that in this case, they'll just do it in the future. If we say you can basically never shrink the amount of supervised release time when there's a revocation proceeding like the first one here, where he got the 4 months and the 30 months, I don't see how that's going to help defendants particularly, because they'll just keep it up at the cap to give themselves flexibility. And I don't see how it, in general, something like this that happens where it turns out that Mr. Rogers doesn't do too well out on supervised release, and the judge is very sympathetic to him, but he just thought he needed a little more time. Is this really what this system is supposed to look like?
No, Your Honor. I would definitely take that. The position is not. I have, in terms of the potential interpretation of Johnson, I think Johnson can be interpreted. And of course, there's some dicta and there's some dissenting opinions in Johnson that can be looked at and support the conclusion that the court cannot enlarge a term of supervised release that's already been shrunk, has been shortened.
Right, right.
And I think there is some argument there, and there is an argument can be made not only on general fairness grounds, but some of the dicta in Johnson. I think that is an argument that I would definitely assert here, even though, of course, I have not briefed that, and I didn't think it was fair to come before this court and assert a new position, or much less fair to the government to assert a new position, given the recent Russell decision.
Can I ask you,
yes, sir.
Do you think that the district judge in this thing was actually operating under E3, or was he operating under E2?
Judge, I think he was just looking at the recommendation that came from the probation office that sets out the statutory max, and he was thinking in his mind, oh, we still have the 60-month statutory max because that's what was allowed under the statute. And as we know, actually, it's a maximum of life in this case, but given that if you've seen those recommendations that come from probation office, they come out and they set it out according to the class of felony.
Fortunately, I left the district court before we had to say
that. Thank you, Judge. there's a recommendation. They set out the statutory max. They set out what kind of felony is, what classification, and what actually is possible under a revocation. And of course, that probation recommendation to the judge, that report, did not include what we know that Shorty said and this court has said before. There could have been a statutory max of life. Do I think it would be fair for Judge Murphy to say, fine, all right, I'm going to give you 4 months, but I'm going to put you back on supervised release for life? Because possibly that's what he could do if he shortened it, expanded it, and put him back on for life if we take it as far as it could be taken. Did I answer your question, Judge? I see my time's up. I don't mean
well,
to...
Well, I just thought E2 may not put us in the box we're in but the circumstances we're in. If he had sentenced actually under E2.
I don't think he was contemplating that, Judge. I think it was in the back of his mind what was in the probation report. Oh, I had 60. So if you look at the transcript, oh, okay, I gave him 6 months first. I gave him 4 months first. Then I gave him 6 months now. So that still leaves me 50 months. I think that he was still thinking of the original calculation. I don't think he was thinking of E2, E1, E3 at all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Lloyd?
Hey, please, the court. My name is Richard Lloyd, and I was the original attorney when Mr. Rogers was sentenced in 1990. And as is a practice in our office, I followed the case since his release from incarceration and his initial revocation and his second revocation. It's the government's position that the correct standard of review in this case is plain error. I think it's clear that Ms. Smith's colleague, Mr. Fleming, never raised the issue of whether or not the court could make an extension of the supervised release during the revocation proceeding. In fact, he even appeared to acquiesce and told his client that this is a new program, and when the court asked the defendant whether or not he wished to appeal, Mr. Fleming told the court that it was not his practice to file frivolous appeals.
But there are a couple of things there. He also, in that very same couple of sentences, alluded to the fact that Mr. Rogers was uncomfortable about the extension of the supervised release period from 30 back up to 50 months. And this court, in its February 25th order, was willing to accept for purposes of that order anyway, that Mr. Rogers had objected. Mr. Rogers did object in kind of a lay sort of way. He raised the issue and said words to the effect of, oh my lord, you know, or whatever. I mean, which I realize isn't as polished as a lawyer might have done it, but he was certainly protesting in some fashion. So isn't it a little harsh to take this, at least that aspect of it, on plain error review as opposed to...
You know, I would submit to the court that Mr. Rogers' statement of, oh my God, could be interpreted in the same instance as the brief filed by Mr. Fleming, that Mr. Rogers was in fact making a U.S. versus Johnson argument that he could not be placed on a subsequent period of supervised release after being revoked. And that's the stance that Mr. Fleming took on the...
Right, we're not bound by Mr. Fleming, of course.
No, we're not, but you know, and oh my God, explanation by the defendant, and if would allow a pro se litigant or a litigant subsequently represented by another counsel to raise any of a number of issues.
Well, it would depend on what preceded, oh my God. Wouldn't it?
That's correct, yeah.
I mean, what other view could you, you know, take from oh my God here? You know, like, oh my God, thank you, or...
Oh my God, I don't want to have any supervision by this probation officer in the future. This is the second time he was revoked. So that could also be the reason why it's, oh my God.
Whatever, it wasn't a cry of joy and salvation here.
No, it wasn't a cry of joy and salvation because Mr. Rogers has been revoked twice for substance abuse. And I think that he realized that his prognosis for the future was fairly limited in terms of being able to stay away from drugs.
Actually, what he says, I mean, when I mean, there's actually conversation about this, because the attorney first says, is that right, Your Honor, 50? I thought he had 30 before, and the judge says, yes, 50. Then Rogers said, I have 30 left. The lawyer says, this is a new program. Rogers, oh, I got some more. The lawyer says, this is new. The court says, this is new. And then Rogers says, Lord have mercy. It seems to me that alerts, in a rough way, the court, the idea that going back up to 50 was something the defendant was unhappy with, objecting to. And it seems a shame in a case like this, since the real legal issue here is whether that 30, whether you have to always look at the amount of supervised release immediately before when you're revoking, or whether you always refer back to the original sentence, or whether you can have this new proceeding to extend back on out to the original sentence. Those are all important questions, since there are a lot of people who don't do well in supervised release. I'm sure you see plenty of them.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I believe that that under Johnson, that we're bound by the original period of supervised release based upon the felony or misdemeanor conviction, in this case, 60 months.
And then the next question is, do we need a new proceeding to get back up to that 60 months when it had gotten reduced down to 30 in the meantime?
Your Honor, as I admitted in my brief, I think that the court did err in terms of not having a separate proceeding under 32.1C1, a new hearing. But there again, Mr. Fleming acquiesced to the new sentence, made no objection about not having a separate hearing. And in terms of what was said during the defendant's allocution, if Judge Murphy had decided to have, instead of saying, of course, you're right, and perhaps I should not extend your supervised release from 30 months back to 50 months, let's have a hearing tomorrow or next week. And based upon the allocution of the defendant in this case, and since the court has wide discretion and the quantum of evidence is within the wide discretion of the court, it's not a preponderance of the evidence, I think clearly on the record it was enough to extend the defendant's supervised release from 30 to 50 months.
You're basically making a harmless error point in a sense.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You're not worrying about plain error, you're saying it was harmless
error.
Well,
if we look at, based upon the defendant's point of view that the standard proof is clear error, I think it's harmless error if under the government's interpretation that no substantial rights were violated, then we're looking at plain error. And I think we come up with the same result. If we send it back, the court would be within its discretion to increase them from 30 months to 50 months.
Could I just ask you where he is now?
I believe at this point, Your Honor, he's probably back on the street, but I think he's finished his 4 month. And there again, I think this goes to one of the points that was made about whether or not the court should be allowed to reduce and then extend. I think if the court doesn't have the carrot and the stick, what we're going to end up with is the courts in all these cases maximizing the amount of supervised release and not rewarding people who do well on supervised release.
Counsel, I'm trying to find it here, but you can tell me. Although you concede that there was error here, what was your recommendation that we should do, action we should take?
Based upon the government's feeling that there was no substantial rights violated because of the facts in this case, that the government believes that this case should be affirmed.
But what about the very cogent point that Ms. Smith brought up, which is, what to keep a district judge from bringing, you know, from saying, okay, now you're under supervised release for the next 30 years, for life, into the next world. I mean, what keeps the judge from doing that?
Well, I think in this case, because this case was prior to the 1994 amendments, we wouldn't have that situation. This was not brought under 3583H. That's a different question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That helps. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.